Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 € pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Covent Garden. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with James Harkin, Anna Chazinski, and Alex Bell. And once again,
No, I'm back from Edinburgh. It's Andy Murray.
I don't recognize that name.
And Andy Murray, and once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our 4 favorite facts from the last 7 days, and in no particular order, here we go. Starting with you, James Harkin.
Okay, my fact this week is that Neanderthals wore capes.
Do they only wear capes?
I think they kind of did, and it seems like...
Is that a good look? Is that a sexy look? I'm just trying
it's
to picture
it. Extra obscene if you're only wearing a cape, I think.
Do you think worse than nudity?
I think it's worse than nudity.
Well, no, it's worse than being naked with just socks on. Like, that's what it is. That looks terrible. Having one item is always just a bit embarrassing.
Absolutely.
No, a cape's quite a good look, because you can wrap it around yourself and then do the big reveal.
So Neanderthals, they wore capes.
They did, compared to early humans who wore more like parkas or hoodies. So the thing is, they found by looking at animal remains in early human settlements and Neanderthal settlements, and they found that the Neanderthals didn't really have the ability to make more complex clothing like the humans could. All they could really do is get an animal skin and just wrap it around their neck like a cape, whereas the humans could kind of make more proper clothing. And they reckon that this may be one of the reasons why the Neanderthals died out when the humans proliferated.
Kind of ironic that they donned superhero gear in order to wipe themselves out. What a bunch of idiots.
I read a thing about superhero capes, and it was a physicist who'd done an analysis on Batman's cape, worked out that if, as in the film, he used the cape to help slow himself down, he would still have hit the building he was landing on at 50 miles an hour, which would have immediately killed him.
I think we're assuming when we watch that there's some magical force holding him up as well as just the sheer force of his cape,
but
aren't
he is
we?
Just a bloke, let's not forget. Batman is a bloke.
He's not like Superman with superpowers, he's just a guy with tons of money.
Oh, I kind of thought he had a little bit of extra magic power as well.
No, his sole superpower is material wealth.
I thought the really interesting thing about this new research that's been done was the idea that early humans, the real superheroes of this story, had fur trim hoodies, it's thought, or fur trim coats, because what the researchers found is that certain animals were found at human sites that weren't found at Neanderthal sites. So I think there were animals like weasels and wolverines that were found on the human sites, and they have like short hairs, and they're the kind of hair that you'd use to make a fur trim. So they've got this whole mixture of fur, and if it's added to sleeves and the hoods of clothes, then it insulates you better.
How are they sewing or putting stuff together?
Well, do you know that the oldest sewing needle was found around this time, around 40,000 years ago?
Really?
Actually, it was found more recently, but it was left 40,000 years ago.
No. It was found 40,000 years ago, but immediately dropped again.
In a haystack.
But weirdly, it wasn't early humans or Neanderthals. It was Denisovians, who were a third group of hominids who kind of lived around the same time.
Oh. Were we the most clever of the bunch at that period?
They definitely had bigger brains than we did.
Ah, well, they had bigger brains, Neanderthals. But there is a theory that, because they had bigger bodies as well, and they had larger eyes too, so they had extremely good vision, but there's a theory that more of their brain would have had to be given over to their visual cortex and to controlling their body as well.
So they were great at kind of gymnastics or seeing things from a long distance. But
the Neanderthal Olympics were brilliant to watch.
And all the audience were 5 miles away as well.
But on the other hand, they couldn't do Rubik's Cubes.
And obviously that really got humans through the Ice Age when it was very boring and you had to have entertainment.
I think scientists have come forward in the last year slightly, not debunking, but saying there's no actual evidence to show that increased focus on your brain on eyesight or body size would mean that you had a less good higher cortex. But it's certainly a theory.
That's the thing. It just changes all the time. Probably everything we're saying right now is just going to be particularly with Neanderthals.
Yeah.
Every day there's a new story that says, they were killed by bunnies or they were loved... have you not heard that theory?
No.
Oh, they were killed by rabbits.
Were
all
they?
Of them.
No.
Yeah. It was to do with the fact that they couldn't... I think I'm gaining this in the sort of area of right. their main source of food also became the main source of food that rabbits were eating, and rabbits were eating all the food. And so they just ran out of food, effectively. So rabbits kind of took... I don't know.
Here's the thing. If you try to live off rabbits your whole life, you wouldn't be able to because they don't contain nearly enough nutrients.
Unless they've eaten all of your other food, and so they contain all the food groups now inside of their bodies.
Yeah. Is this an all-you-can-eat rabbit situation?
Yeah,
or is it...
if the only thing you could ever eat was rabbits, you would die.
No!
And you'd die quite quickly as well. I'm not sure exactly what it is that you're missing. I think it's a famous kind of thought experiment about rabbits in particular.
Really? And lots of other things, presumably. Or are rabbits the only ones trying to screw us over?
Well, yeah, you could probably live just off Guinness.
Yeah, okay, James. Good luck with that.
They always say that, don't they? They say, like, 2 pints of Guinness and 3 Mars bars will get you through the rest of your life. But it doesn't sound right.
Who says that?
Irish people.
Did you know, because people always used to say, drinking a Guinness is the same as having 7 roast dinners or something, that there's the same number of calories in a pint of Tennent's or a pint of Foster's as there is in a pint of Guinness? I always thought there was way more in Guinness.
Yeah,
it feels like there's more when you drink it, doesn't there?
Yeah, it does.
Does it?
Yeah, it's heavy. It's thicker.
I don't know.
You had a full pint of beer for your birthday the other day, didn't you, Andy?
Yeah, fruit beer. You know. I really like this clothing thing because it's sort of interesting in the knock-on effects that things have. So, if Neanderthals only had capes, as we're saying, then they might have only been able to hunt during the very warmest bits of the day.
Right.
So that limits your hunting range time-wise. It means you can't hunt in the morning or the evening. Or it might have stopped them foraging further north, whereas if you've got humans in sort of parka-like fur things, they can hunt further north. That extends the range. Or in that part of Europe, ambush is quite a good means of killing prey because you use the landscape and you wait for animals to come along and then you jump out and kill them rather than chasing them as early humans did in Africa, for example.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you're just lying down in a cape all day, you can't do it. You'll freeze.
Do you remember there's that book that came out called The Singing Neanderthals?
Yes.
Yeah, so this is a professor from Reading University called Stephen Mithen, and he believes that they sung a lot and they liked to dance and clap, and they used to do it in their caves together. They used to sing in groups.
I have read that book quite a few years ago, and I think, is it not also that he thinks that language came originally from singing.
Yes.
So people would just kind of sing and get rhythm, and then that rhythm and noise would turn into meanings, and then that meaning would turn into language. I think that's what he's
talking about. Yeah. So for that reason as well, the language part, he says that he thinks that they would particularly have liked rap music. he says, I can see them rapping in my mind.
He thinks a lot of stuff, this guy. Neanderthal males had one massive arm and one puny one.
No.
Like Nadal.
Like Nadal. Exactly like Nadal. Athletes, cricket and tennis players in particular, have upper arm bones which are much stronger in their dominant arm, right?
Oh, of course.
So all of us here, our dominant arm will be between 5 and 14% bigger. This is the arm bone, the upper arm bone, bigger than on the other side, right? In Neanderthals, the upper arm bone is 50% bigger than on the other side.
Yeah.
And this is only the case in cricket and tennis players in modern humans today. So when you say Nadal, it's absolutely right. And they thought that this was because they were doing spear thrusting, right, to hunt animals. But actually, they got modern humans to sort of practice thrusting spears and measured how much energy it used. And actually, that uses the non-dominant arm loads too. So they reckon that what it is processing animal hides, i.e. scraping laboriously away at the inside of animal skins to make them suitable for wearing your capes. And we don't know if female Neanderthals had the same thing because we haven't found female Neanderthal skeletons where both arms are present, but we have found male ones. Yeah.
Do we know that female Neanderthals had 2 arms?
No, we don't. No. Which might be a reason why they died out.
just one thing on capes, that capes were quite big in the Aztec world. And Montezuma particularly was into them in that every year he collected a tribute from his people of 2,560 of them.
The word escape comes from the word cape.
Does it?
What? Yeah.
It's like when someone grabs your cape, but you could run away because you kind of leave them with the cape.
Then you're just naked if you're a Neanderthal.
According to the etymological dictionary of the English language, to escape is to escape oneself, to slip out of your cape and run away.
Oh, that's cool.
Isn't that
fantastic.
Great?
Yeah.
Were there any famous villains that were known for that? Like Jack the Ripper, we've got his cape, you know. Was there any...
Like just with the cape done up by poppers at the front or something that they just whip off and lose?
Well, just if...
That's Jack the Stripper you're thinking of.
But another kind of cape in the Aztec world that only Aztec rulers were allowed to wear was the hummingbird cape. And so hummingbirds were sort of revered by Aztecs because I think of their tenacity and the fact that they'd attack things that were bigger than them and they wouldn't rest until they'd got what they wanted. And so Aztec kings could wear capes made entirely of hummingbird feathers.
I think I've seen one of those.
Yeah, they're pretty spectacular.
I think there might be one in a museum in Hawaii or something.
Oh, really?
So, like really yellow, amazing kind of feathery cape.
Hummingbirds, I think, are they the only bird that can fly backwards?
Yeah.
But yeah, one cape would take 8,000 hummingbirds.
Ooh.
How do you, quite impressive to catch though that many though.
It is.
That's
you probably
what the king did all year.
Sneak up on them from the front.
Yeah.
Elvis Presley famously used to wear a cape
in
the later years. And the very first time that they had the idea for the cape, because the idea was that it was going to be used to reveal himself, not in that way, on stage, to the audience. It was a great way of hiding himself before if they could
but
see
it. Because you can still see the cape, obviously. So.
Yeah, I guess, but you're like, who's behind the cape? I mean, yeah, they're at a Presley gig. All right, thing is that with the cape, so he commissioned it from this guy who was in another bit of America, and so they made the cape, and they sent it over on a plane, and Elvis put it on, and it was so heavy that as he walked forward, he immediately got dragged back by the weight of it and crashed backwards onto the ground.
Wow. Yeah. Like, who did that in the VMAs last year or something? Was it Madonna?
I think she just fell down forward.
Did she not get dragged? No, she got dragged off by a cape.
She did. Oh, someone did stepped she? On the back of her cape. Maybe it was just a tribute to Elvis. No one got.
Someone else who had a massive cape on stage was Liberace.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Famously. He one time had such a massive cape. He was brought on stage in a custom-made Rolls-Royce. And then he took off his cape, which was then taken off stage by a smaller Rolls-Royce.
No! That's fantastic.
That's ridiculous.
I was looking at Sherlock Holmes, because he wore a cape.
Yes, he did, yeah.
Described as wearing a cape. And that he was illustrated wearing a very sort of famous cape.
I think it became famous because he'd worn it. I don't think it was a famous cape that Sherlock Holmes adopted. Who is this weird bloke inside my favourite cape?
Sorry, you're absolutely right. He popularised that cape. But there was something really bizarre about the stories in that the man who was commissioned to draw the stories ended up not drawing them. His brother sort of got the gig somehow instead. But then he drew... The man who'd originally been commissioned to draw the cape was then the model for the cape, which his brother ended up drawing for the stories.
Was that a consolation prize thing?
Kind of,
his brother was like, oh, sorry, I didn't get the gig.
Is it really weird, these Victorian... Because there was a coat with a cape built into it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't really understand it. Is it just to protect you against rain, or...?
Just fashion.
Yeah, must have been fashion. Yeah, because I was trying to work out, was there a purpose to Darth Vader's cape? And a lot of people, because he's in space, what's he doing with the cape? There's a lot of anti-gravity going on. That's not a useful garment to have. A lot of people say that it was because of his authority and that a cape would suggest a military kind of authority for some reason.
But then I don't really know much about Star
Wars.
But it doesn't seem like they have a lot of problem with anti-gravity at any stage.
Which is, it's interesting, isn't it? The one scene where I think you should see that is when he's flying, when Vader's in his own ship, because I imagine that's where anti-gravity kicks in. But he must be sitting on the cape, that's what I thought, because you don't see it in shot.
You're right, because they must have thought this through.
Well, they have, because look, there's a description on Wikipedia about his entire outfit. So the outer cape was made so that it could block fire and acid jets, helping to protect the suit's electronics, because remember, Darth Vader was part robot. And Yeah, but the cape was so heavy, get this, the cape was so heavy that it restricted movement, so he had difficulty lifting his arms over his head, which is why you rarely see that in the movies.
Really?
Yeah. I can't really see a scene where that would have fitted in.
It's when he does the YMCA.
it's when he's at that football match and the Mexican wave comes around his way.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Board-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is Chasinski.
My fact this week is that when the first ballpoint pen was launched in the US, riot police had to be deployed to restrain the crowds. It was the new iPhone of its day. This was in 1945, and I actually read about this in a book I've just bought called Adventures in Stationery by James Ward. And this ballpoint pen was brought to America by a guy called Milton Reynolds. It was 29th of October, 1945, and he launched it in a department store called Gimbel's in New York, and thousands of people came. So I think 5,000 people swarmed Gimbel's department store, and 50 extra policemen had to be deployed as an emergency at the last minute because it was being swarmed so much. So they cost the equivalent of $160 now, which is a lot, but still they sold, you know, they'd sold millions.
That
in
makes
the first
sense.
Few
presumably
yeah.
they weren't yeah. the really crummy, cheap buyers that you were paying $160 for. Because that was a time of some hardship across the world, right?
Well, what he was thinking, actually, you say it's of some hardship. A, they didn't work because he rushed them through. But B, I think he was thinking it's the end of the war. I need to launch it now. People want a treat.
Mm. Well, that war was terrible, but at least we've got a barrel. It's almost worth having another war.
It was called the Reynolds Rocket, though, so there was a little bit of militarization going on in there.
Oh, yeah.
He actually took out an ad in the New York Times to promote it, a full-page ad. That's how big they were promoting the thing. And in it, he said that it was fantastic, miraculous pen, guaranteed to write for 2 years without refilling.
Yeah, and you got your money back if it didn't.
And a lot of people did, didn't they?
Yeah, loads of people,
It was 104,643 had to be replaced in the first 8 months.
So I think, it had massive problems. It was really leaky, or it would stop writing altogether. It just wasn't a very good design. And the reason was because he was a very competitive businessman. So there was this chap called Laszlo Biro, who a few years beforehand had invented the Biro in Europe, and he'd brought it to Argentina. And word had reached America and this guy Milton Reynolds of the Biro, and he really wanted to patent the design, which was just this round tip and this capillary action, which meant that you could write in all directions and the ink wouldn't bleed out onto the page. Anyway, he tried to buy the patent for the design, and it had already been sold. And so he was so pissed off, he decided to rush through his own design before Biro could get his out. So he knew that Biro in 1945, which was now run by a company called Evershard, I think, he knew that they were about to rush a design out, and so he put his out prematurely.
But the thing was that his didn't use capillary action.
No.
His relied on gravity, so Darth Vader wouldn't have been able to use it, for instance.
Mm.
Indeed.
That's
yeah.
why you never saw him signing papers.
Actually, there is a theory, which Andy was just pointing, so I bet he was about to say this,
yeah.
that there is no writing in the whole Star Wars universe.
Theory is a post-literary universe.
Oh.
You just see people pointing at, you know, pressing buttons with little symbols on them.
Right.
Apparently there are some scrolls that the Jedi's, you can see it in the background occasionally that there's a scroll there, but whether they have writing on, we don't know.
Well, also, you can see in, this is getting too geeky now, but you can see in Raiders of the Lost Ark, when they have the Ark of the Covenant, there are symbols on the Ark of the Covenant of R2-D2 and C-3PO. Oh, so they've now put that in a suggested LucasArts timeline of the universe. So, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, was remembered close enough on Earth that they knew about 3PO and R2-D2. So it's not that long ago.
Mm. Yeah.
So when you said this is too geeky, I was about to say, no, it can't be too geeky for this show, but you managed to do it.
So the first, one of the first big orders for Biros was by the RAF, actually, during the Second World War. So this was by the Laszlo Biro inventor himself.
Was he called Biro?
I think it's originally pronounced Biro.
We've been saying it wrong all these years.
It's probably Laszlo as well.
Laszlo Biro, yeah. I think. I think it's Biro.
Probably. He was Hungarian. Well, he was born in Budapest.
Right.
He was Hungarian. Then he moved to Argentina. So this is a really weird thing also about the way he invented it. He had to flee the Nazis, mm-hmm. and he went to Argentina, partly because he'd had a chance encounter on a beach with a fellow holidaymaker and told him about this great invention he had. And the fellow holidaymaker said, "Oh, well, I'm the president of Argentina, so do you want to come and set up in my country?" And he said, "Thank you very much, I will." And isn't that amazing?
It's extraordinary. They're on the beach and they're happy to be chatting to the Argentinian president.
Yeah.
He was the former president.
But then, really tragically, Biro never made much money from it because he had sold the patent to it very early on in the process. Because partly, I think, to get more of his family out of Europe.
Mm-hmm. I think his last shares were sold to get his family to Argentina.
Yeah,
Dixon I really Myers. Love. I love the sound of this guy Biro because apparently, before he invented the biro, he was a hypnotist, a race car driver, and a surrealist painter.
Wow. That's awesome.
It sounds amazing. And you'll like how he invented the ballpoint pen, Andy. He was just sat there looking out of a window and he saw a marble go through a puddle and then it left a line of water on the ground. And he thought, wait a minute, I could make a pen like that.
Did he know?
Yeah.
Because, Andy, you really hate these ideas of serendipity in inventions.
I don't hate it. I just think that often inventions are... It's so much nicer, the story of Biro seeing a child playing with marbles and the marble going through the puddle. And who knows? That may well be the case. But often you get the whole, oh, yes, he had invented a whole load of fountain pens and then one of them was dropped and it created a weird ball on the end of it. And you thought, oh, I know.
Yeah, because Biro didn't actually invent the ballpoint pen, or he wasn't the first person to come up with a patent for it.
No.
I think it was John Loud.
Yes.
Who did have the first patent, and he wanted something that would be able to write on wrapping paper. And he invented this thing, but unfortunately it was just a rubbish design.
There were 350 ballpoint patents before Biro came
Whoa,
up with his.
Oh, really?
Yeah. From, you're right, John Loud, in I think the 1880s. All the way through to the 1930s. The idea had been thought of a lot, it's just no one had made it work properly.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's weird that he had to wait for a marble to propel itself through a puddle.
Yeah, it is a bit weird, isn't it?
Considering there were 350 other inventions exactly the same as his.
It's bizarre. It's almost as though that did not happen.
Have we ever talked about, just speaking of riots and police having to be called unexpectedly, about the girl who put a Facebook invitation up and accidentally made it public, not private, the Dutch girl, in 2012, and she got 30,000 people responding saying that they would attend.
About a party, was it?
It was, yeah, it was about a party, but it meant to go to just her friends, and apparently you have some private setting on Facebook.
You do.
There's a movie about it, isn't there?
Is there?
Yeah, I can't remember what it's called.
Oh, no, it was based on that film, why people did it, and then they turned up in T-shirts saying Project X Haren, because it was in the town of Haren. And yeah, like up to 5,000 people turned up and 600 riot police had to be called and the girl fled her home to somewhere else because she'd accidentally put this invitation on private. It sounds absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, it happens quite a lot.
What, 5,000 people rocking up to an impromptu
certainly doesn't my
party accidentally?
You did say up to 5,000 people. I mean, even at Andy's parties, there's up to 5,000 people.
Okay, it is time for fact number 3, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that not only was Lady Chatterley's lover banned from Australia, but a book about the ban was also banned. Lady Chatterley's Lover, famously a book that was banned in the UK, it was banned in Australia, many other countries, and what happened was in 1960... Eventually, after, I believe it was 1929, it was originally banned. So, huge amount of time, and they finally got the ban lifted. And it was such a weird trial. Everyone who was at the trial reported about it at the time in 1960, because they had things like the fact that the jury, who were forced to read the book, weren't even allowed to bring the book out of the courtroom. So the jury had to just sit in the jury room and read the book.
There was probably somebody really smug juror who got to the end of it first before everybody else.
Yeah, just did all the spoilers. She shags him.
That reminds me of something I read, that in the 90s, or late 80s, early 90s, there was a pornographic TV channel called Red Hot Dutch, which came over to Britain because people could get it with their satellite dishes. Mm-hmm. And there was a big kind of moral crusade against it in the newspapers and stuff. And before the Parliament could debate it, they had to have a special viewing of the channel in the Houses of Parliament. And apparently it was one of the most well-attended viewings of anything that they ever had.
Wow. I don't know, because, oh, you're allowed to watch some really steamy hot Dutch pornography, but you have to watch it in a room full of MPs. I'm not sure I'd click attending. So the really tricky thing when the book was going to be published is that this was all after a 1959 change in the law, which said that literary merit is a defence. So it was an extremely sexually explicit book. It had been banned in 1929, but then this change in the law in 59 meant that suddenly there is a possible defence, which means that it could be published legally. And Penguin then announced, you know, for Lawrence's anniversary, we are going to publish a huge run of this. And they were intending to publish it for, I think, 3 shillings and sixpence, which is really cheap and would have put it well within the reach of working class people. So that was why the authorities, if you like, were spooked.
Yeah, because there was still the thing in law, which was an old Victorian thing, which was, it's all right for you to have something which is explicit and obscene and whatever, so long as only gentlemen can read it. But once you do it so that the poor people can read it, then it becomes a problem.
Yeah.
And it's called variable obscenity.
And, really?
Yeah. And so there's a very famous part of that trial where the chief prosecutor, who's called Mervyn Griffith Jones, asked the jurors to consider if it was the kind of book that you would wish your wife or servants to read. And in the newspapers, they all thought that was hilarious because, you know, this is the 1960s. We don't talk like that anymore. But of course, he was referring to the old Victorian law, which was, is it something that working class people or women or whatever can read as opposed to gentlemen like me?
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when they eventually lifted the ban and said it could be sold in shops, it's not dissimilar to the great ballpoint pen debut.
Indeed.
Shops were packed. People were not rioting, but it was chaotic, and it was mainly men who just heard so much about this book. And copies that had been bought were then being resold just the hour later in Soho.
Oh. It's also a very quick read. So.
Yeah. But people were, it's almost like when a huge superstar comes into town, you know, scalpers buy up the tickets and resell them for a hiked price. So in Soho, they were hiking the price of these unread books that had just been bought in the London bookshops. So just to bring it back quickly to the opening fact, so what ended up happening was that the ban was lifted, and that was great, and someone then went on to write a book called The Trial of Lady Chatterley's Lover. And that book then got released here in the UK, and it attempted to get released in Australia, but Australia had not lifted their own ban, and so they decided to continue to ban anything to do with Lady Chatterley, and that was one of the books that wasn't allowed in.
So did this book have, like, excerpts from the original, do you think?
Yeah, no, I'm not sure exactly what this book contains. It's actually quite hard to find it online.
Well, it's because you're part Australian, Dan.
Yes, exactly.
You're just not allowed to read anything like this.
Yeah. What's really nice about this is that a group of Australians actually decided that they were going to sneakily import it and start selling it in shops, and they did. And that kind of created a new conversation once they got caught, because they were caught and the government attempted to prosecute them. And they said this shouldn't be done, and a lot of other politicians agreed. And as a result, that's what's kind of kickstarted the whole thing about the relaxation laws of the obscenity laws in Australia. So it's interesting. Lady Chatterley itself did it here, and in Australia, a book about the trial did it in Australia. Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. You'd have customs officials taking banned books off people.
Apparently, when trains used to go from Europe into the Soviet Union, when they stopped on the border, they check your passports, and there'd also be a guy going through going, Bibles and pornography! Bibles and pornography!
No way.
And so you had to give up your Bibles or pornography.
Wow. Oh my God.
Apparently.
I know what it looks like. It's just actually a very broadly interpreted Bible.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo.
Und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Board-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte dein Test noch heute für 1 € pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show, and that is Andrew Hunter Murray.
My fact is that Henry VIII contributed to NASA spacesuit design.
Go on. How?
So he had a suit of armor, which was built for him in 1520 for a thing called the Field of the Cloth of Gold, this huge diplomatic jolly in France. And in 1962, one of the teams working on spacesuits for NASA, a firm called Garrett AI Research, they visited the suit, and the Tower of London sent the firm data on it, and they sent photos of it, because they were trying to work out how to build better suits which could, you know, completely overlap and completely cover the body. And that was sort of, you know, something that went into their research.
Yeah, so cool.
Yeah.
So now you're going to have astronauts with massive cod pieces.
Yeah.
That'd be good though, wouldn't it?
Great.
Yeah. So good. He did have a bigger one than everyone else, didn't he? The king had to cod be shown piece. With a bigger cod piece.
Yeah. Yes.
Indeed. Yeah. Women in subsequent centuries used to put little pinpricks in them, and it was hoped that that would make them fertile and bring them babies.
Isn't that at the Tower of London? Yeah. There's an actual, yeah.
Were
yeah.
you there? We were shown around the Tower of
no.
London.
No. What? When was that?
A good few years ago, I was shown around the Royal Armouries. With Molly Oldfield, I think, for her book, The Secret Museum. And they have the copies there, and I think they have the actual one which the pins were pricked in.
Oh, cool. Really?
That's so cool. Yeah.
Henry VIII had regular enemas from a pig's bladder, didn't he? So I actually thought that this fact was going to be, I think I may have misread your email, that the spacesuit was designed on Henry VIII's bottom. And so I did quite a lot of research into Henry VIII's bottom. So I was also reading about his toilet. And they were really lavish, but I didn't really understand this. I think this was from Lucy Worsley, maybe, said Henry VIII's lavatory was lavishly covered in black velvet, its lid opened to reveal inside a padded and beribboned interior covered with the same material.
Oh, God.
Those ribbons are going to be very nice for one use only.
That's a really good point. I mean,
I think there must have been a hole in the middle, which, and maybe you had to aim well and just make sure you didn't catch the padding and the ribbons on the
what?
Outside, maybe?
No.
Yeah.
It feels maybe. Like with that many enemas, his aim wouldn't have been so good.
How long after it's someone dies test. Is it not treason anymore?
So he got very fat later in life.
Yeah.
He was quite athletic when he was young, wasn't he? But he got really fat later on. And I read this, that there was a 2009 study by the Royal Armouries that found that his waist was 52 inches. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's by looking at one of his suits of armour. But brilliantly, by coincidence, Queen Victoria's bloomers that went on sale in 2012 were also a 52-inch waist.
Wow.
So they had exactly wow. the same waistline, wow. Queen Victoria and Henry VIII.
So this fact is also about spacesuits and NASA. Did you know spacesuits these days are called emus? That's what modern spacesuits are referred to.
Ah.
So in space, you need to go and get into your emu.
So I bet U is unit.
Not bad.
Extra.
Yep. Ooh, what's it going
to
be?
I'll leave the next one to you, Anna.
Mission. Mammary.
No, I know.
I'm
going to put us all out of all of our misery. It's extravehicular mobility units. Yeah.
Hang on, so where's the V?
FMU. Should
yeah.
be. Yeah. Except there's not a bird.
But that's not a lovable creature. Yeah. Yeah.
If you want to study ants in using an electron microscope, you would look at them in a vacuum. And to get them in a vacuum, you have to put them in a tiny little spacesuit.
No!
Well, they call it a tiny spacesuit. It's like you dip them in surfactant, which is a substance which causes like a tiny little nano suit, basically, that they go inside. And it actually can even repair itself if it gets broken. But yeah, they call it a tiny little ant spacesuit.
Is it individual ones for individual ants?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
I know.
That is so
That's
cool.
Incredible.
Have you seen, I was looking at amusing looking spacesuit designs from over the years, and NASA have tried some pretty wacky stuff, but have you seen the AX5 hard shell spacesuit?
we've seen the AX3, haven't we? But
yeah,
no,
we have. Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
not sure.
I knew you weren't up to date on this. So the AX5, the point was that you wanted to be flexible inside it. So that's often a problem in spacesuits, that you can't like move around enough. And it had a flexibility rating of 95%, which means that the wearer can move into 95% of the positions that you can if you were naked. But what this basically means is, if you look it up...
So I wanted
reverse cowgirl...
What are the positions that you can't get in?
I don't know, actually. Maybe they don't tell you in case you try and break it.
I'm not sure I can get into all that many positions, even when naked.
You might only have a 75% thing even without the spacesuit on.
Oh, God. And each year as I get older, it gets less, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Look, it's a funny spacesuit. It's not that morbid. It looks like someone's inflated a Michelin
man. So if I wear this... if I wear this 95% spacesuit, does that mean I can now get into more positions?
No, sadly not.
I'm afraid it's not 95% of the average person's. It's 95% of your position's naked. Oh, your naked God. Is 100%. You could barely do anything.
So
in
I
the
could actually only get down to about 71.5%.
Yes. Don't buy it.
If only you could transmute your consciousness into an AX5 spacesuit, then you'd be able to do more than you could today.
How many percentage do you think you could do wearing just a cape?
That's over 100.
110.
Sorry.
So spacesuits...
Have you finished that?
No. I just need to describe how this works. Because it's ridiculous.
We know it. The AX5.
AX5, we know. Gosh, we know the AX5.
The AX5 looks like a hugely inflated Michelin man. So essentially, it's like being in a giant bubble where it seems like you can pull most of your limbs out of the sleeves and sort of your legs out of the legs and move around inside it.
Right.
But it looks totally absurd because it looks like you've put on a piece of clothing 20 sizes too big for you. Mm. So they decided not to let it go. But it's, you know, a good amount of roominess in there just with your head hanging onto the helmet and the rest of your body can swing around underneath it.
That's a good idea, actually.
A really good idea.
Should we wrap up?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Oh, do you know what the French for cod piece is?
Le poisson.
I thought you'd go down that road.
Le pièce de poisson.
It's not. It's braguette, spelt the same as baguette, but with
braguette.
An R. Which oh seems to have That's so much fantastic. Room for confusion.
Braguettes for breakfast? Yeah. Oh, my God.
Brilliant for a French 16th century sitcom, wouldn't it?
Yeah, a stupid farce. Just put a braguette over your penis and get on with it. Are you sure? Madame's halfway through eating it.
Okay, that's it. That's all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we have said over the course of this podcast, we can be found on our Twitter accounts. I'm on at Schreiberland, James.
At Eggshaped.
Andy.
At Andrew Hunter M.
And Jasinski.
You can email podcast@qi.com.
Yep, or you can go to our group Twitter account, which is @QIPodcast, or go to nosuchthingasafish.com, which is where we have all of our previous episodes. Also, why not go to iTunes? All of our first year of Fish is up there now. You can buy that too. And we will be back again next week with another episode. We'll see you then. Goodbye.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Board-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.